So today we're going to use slides because I have way too much stuff to tell you and not enough time. Now, using slides is dangerous, so please tell me if I'm going too fast. If you at any point want me to show you the previous slide, just tell me. We should be fine. I don't think there's way too much stuff, but we'll see. Now I have a question. Is this readable enough? I have two versions. There's dark background with white on top and the other way around. So can you all read this? Is it clear? I think it's better because having this white thing blown at you for an hour is not great. But if at any point you want me to switch to the black and white one, you just tell me and I'll do that. Okay, so before we start, any questions about what we did last time?
Not yes. Last time, but these are going to be in the portal?
What do you say?
These are going to be in the portal?
Yes, I'm going to post the slides on the portal. No questions? Yes?
It's a question about what we did at the very end. I'm not super, like, when you did this expansion and divergent orders of our time ordering form.
Yes, DOP.
That's the point. I'm not super sure how it relates to the OP we saw in Jomis' part. Like, is it exactly the same, the OP expansion?
It's the same idea. I'm going to review that, so I'll get back on that. Any other questions? Okay, then let's start. So the outline for today is this. We're going to start with reviewing the last thing from last time because it was done at the very last moment, so I didn't have a lot of time to talk about it. So there was the OPEs, but we're just doing OPEs with the energy momentum tensor. Then we're going to finally get to this Virasoro algebra. We're going to talk about asymptotic states, and we're going to figure out what the Hilbert space of CFT is in two dimensions when we're using this radial quantization procedure. And I'm going to give a very brief overview of null states. I'm going to tell you almost nothing about null states. I just want to tell you they exist, essentially. So it's not too much stuff. I hope that we're going to be able to get through it. Okay, so let's start with the review. The last thing we did last time was starting from the fact that our variation in a primary field phi when we perform an infinitesimal conformal transformation is this. So this we just get by taking the expression that we had, the one with df over dz to the power of minus h, df bar over dz bar to the power of minus h bar. We just go into an expansion in terms of epsilon, then we take the derivative at the first order, we just keep the first order, and we end up with this. But we know that quantum mechanically, the change in the operator phi should be given by the commutator with the charge associated to the change. And when we try to equate these two things, we're going to get integrals, complex integrals. And if you try to match all the operators on both sides, and to make this into an integral, you just use Cauchy's integral formula. So you take derivatives here of psi and you make them into an integral over z minus w squared. And then psi, you just put it as an integral of z minus w, you equate the terms, and you end up with this expression. Now, this symbol here just means that these are not exactly equal. They're only equal up to some terms here that I didn't put, which are regular terms. So they are of the order other constants, or of the order z minus w, or z minus w squared, and so on. And we don't really care about those, because the idea of this is that this is an OP. We only care about what happens when we look at this from far away. So this is indeed one of the OPEs that Jaume was talking about. It's just that we're not considering, because we don't have time, the general one between any two primary operators. I'm just using the OPE between a primary operator and dz, which, by the way, is not actually a primary operator. So this is just one example of an OPE. And we can find this just by actually doing all the integrals we have. You could, in general, do OPEs of all kinds of operators, but we don't really have time to do that. And we didn't really do this, but it's exactly the same procedure. If you use T bar, that's the anti-holomorphic part of the energy momentum tensor, you're going to be able to match the remaining terms. So last time we got these two terms. Now this term here matches this term. That's the one with the H in front. This term matches this term. That's the one that has the derivative of phi. So we get derivative of phi. And we have two terms, this one and this one, that we didn't match. So those two are matched to t bar of z bar. So these two things are the OPEs with the energy momentum tensor, or at least the anti-holomorphic and holomorphic part. Now, these are very important because you can actually use these two relations as the definition of phi being a primary operator. Instead of saying phi is primary if it transforms this way, you can say phi is primary if the OPE with t and t bar are exactly these two. And you can read from the coefficients here and here what the conformal dimension is. So that's how you can find out the conformal dimension of a primary field.
Sorry.
Yes?
Where do you find the dimension?
Just in H and H bar. So if you take any phi being any field, you take the OPE with the energy momentum tensor. And you find something that looks like this, then first of all, you know it's a primary field. And then if you want to know what the dimension is, you just look at the coefficient here and here. Whatever number you have there, that gives you the dimension. So the one that appears here, that's going to be the one for H. This is for H bar. And with both of them, you figure out scaling dimension and spin of the operator. Now, why is this important? You can actually do these things without knowing anything about what we've done before, all the integrals, and so on. We're going to actually see this at a tutorial this afternoon. If I just give you a theory with the Lagrangian and you figure out the energy momentum tensor, you just go and take this product with the radial ordering and see what happens. If you get something like this, then you know whether an operator is primary or not. Is this sort of clear? Yes?
So I'm looking at what we did with Jomet about this OPE.
Yes.
There was this thing that we have these two operators and we want to do an expansion in the distance between them.
Yes, and we're trying to expand them in such a way that you get the combination of all the other primaries, essentially.
Yeah.
So this is the same idea. You can do that. It's done also in two dimensions. We're just not getting to it. You can do the OPE between phi 1 and phi 2, and then write it just as a combination of all the other primaries. So you can still do that. This is kind of like that, but technically, as we're going to see in a moment, this is not a primary. So this is not exactly the same kind of OPE. Because that OPE is just you have two primaries, phi I and phi j, and then phi 1 and phi 2. And then you try to do the expansion in terms of all the other primaries. So this is not exactly the same, but it's kind of like that. And in fact, you can just derive this thing without knowing anything about OPEs and just go on with your life without knowing the existence of OPEs. So it just happens to be something like that. So for the time being, just believe that this thing is true, which I kind of proved to you last time, and you can do yourself. I'm probably going to do something about this thing of figuring out integrals and getting these expressions out of it. I'm going to put that in the homework so you can actually practice with this, because you didn't really do that. Okay, so that was for the review. Now we finally get to this Virasoro algebra. Okay, so let's start with this. We know that T and T bar are holomorphic and anti-holomorphic. So we can just write them as a Lorentz series, both of them. So we're going to write them like this. This is the expression for Tz, and this with the bar on top of Z is the expression for T bar. Now notice that I chose minus n minus 2 instead of just n that you would generally use. It's just a convention, and we're going to see in the next slide why this makes sense. And the expression for ln is going to be then just 1 over 2 pi I, which is always there. And then you have the integral, and this time it's z to the n plus 1 because it needs to match the minus n minus 2 that we had on the other side. Now keep in mind that both ln and L bar n are going to be operators. So these are integrals, but they are integrals that output operators. So these are all operators, so we still have to care about what happens with ordering and all those nice things. So this is just, we've done things like this before, just write something that is holomorphic or anti-holomorphic as a Lorentz series. Now, why is this NEL? Try to remember the form of these integrals. In fact, I'm going to just write one on the board so you can see it. So I'm just going to write one of them. Ln is 1 over 2 pi I. The integral dz, n plus 1 dz. Can you see this without the lights? We don't really need it. It's just so that you remember it for the next slide. Okay, so at this point, remember that we've seen this last time. If we're doing an infinitesimal conformal transformation, so we have z goes to z plus some small parameter epsilon, and xi, which is just an holomorphic field, and z bar just goes to the complex conjugate of this thing, then the associated charge is going to be the integral, still with the 1 over 2 pi I in front. We're going to integrate psi times t, and then we're going to have psi bar times t bar, where the two parts. Last time I just wrote plus anti-holomorphic part for this. This time I have it here because I don't have to actually write anything. So might as well put it there. And remember, this comes from the fact that we're doing this radial quantization. So the xy variable we have, x is our Euclidean time, y is our space variable. But because we're on the cylinder, y is actually wrapping around itself. So we can do this integral on a closed curve. We're essentially doing this integral on a circle, but the circle in the complex plane is a slice of our cylinder. Okay, so this is the way we define our Q epsilon. Now, in general, we've seen at the very beginning of this 2D CFT thing that psi can be written as a Lorentz series in terms of, well, just writing z to the n plus 1. Again, this is just convention. So this is what we've done to find the conformal algebra in the first place. But then if you plug this expression into the thing that we had here, so you just replace psi with the sum over n a n z to the n plus 1, you're going to end up with this expression. And this is exactly this, which is why I chose the coefficient z to the minus n minus 2 like that, because now we just have this expression here with the 2 pi I in front. It's just going to be ln. And this one is just going to be L bar n. So you can just write this charge as a linear combination of the ln and the L bar n. So remember that these things are the generators of conformal transformations at the quantum level, which means these ln and L bar n, in some sense, are the generators of the generators of conformal transformations. By which I mean you can write any generator, Q psi, as a linear combination of these ones. So these are the ones that generate everything. So we expect these things to be exactly the generators of the conformal algebra at the quantum level. And in fact, I'm calling them L, just like we call L, N, but with a lowercase l, all the generators we used to have at the classical level. Now, you might have noticed that we're missing a minus sign. When we did things classically, there was a minus sign here, and there was a minus also in the definition of our ln, the classical ones. Ln used to be minus z to the n plus 1. And now it seems like everything is without the minus. So you may wonder, where did the minus end up? And I don't know. I have no idea where the minus ended up. It disappeared, and there may be several explanations for it, and I don't actually know why. So I'm sorry I cannot actually tell you. One of the reasons may be that we're doing integrals counterclockwise, and that's swallowing up the minus sign, but I'm not actually sure. So we're just going to deal with it and pretend nothing happened. Okay, so we expect ln L bar n to be, being fancy, a representation of the conformal algebra generators on the Hilbert space of the conformal field theory. Because they need to generate conformal transformations, and the way we implement symmetries in quantum mechanics is that we add representations of whatever the algebra only group they were talking about. In this case, we don't really have a Lie group, so we only can deal with the algebra, because remember, there is no group that has this algebra. That's one of the problems that we're facing. Now, we have a small problem with this. It's not really a problem. It's actually a feature. And the feature is, when we're working with quantum mechanics, we have to allow for projective representations of the algebra that we're using. Do you remember why this is the case?
Because wave functions are only defined up to a phase.
Yes, because the wave functions are only defined up to a phase. And in fact, any scalar multiplication, because you don't, if you normalize them to one, then yes, they're only defined up to a phase. If you don't normalize them, they are defined up to any multiplication by any non-zero complex number. So because of that, we have to allow for projective representations, which means that when we define representations, we can also multiply by any other complex number, and it doesn't really change things. Now, you can either do this, or you can use central extensions of your group or your algebra. Most of the time, this is not done because most of the things we deal with have trivial central extension. So for example, if you're dealing with SU2, SU2 doesn't have a non-trivial central extension, so you don't have to deal with this. The Poincaré group does not have a non-trivial central extension, you don't have to deal with this. If you try to do things that are non-relativistic and use the Galilean group instead of the Poincaré group, that has a central extension and you actually have to deal with that. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but that's one of the cases. Yes?
I don't know if you have said that before, but what is a central extension?
I didn't actually say that before. So we have this central extension thing that is just hovering in the room. And I'm going to give an example instead of trying to explain all the math behind it, because there's a lot of math behind it. Just know that what I'm telling you is because we're dealing with quantum mechanics, quantum theory in general, and we have this projective representation problem, which sends us to this. So our algebra ln L bar n, they are kind of going to be the same as the generators of the conformal algebra. So we expect the commutators to have this piece. But then we're going to add something else. So this is the central extension. The central extension is we're adding an extra term, which we're going to call C. Now, technically, this C is an operator, but we're just going to think of it as a number because it commutes with everything else. That's the idea of the central extension. That's what central means. It's in the center of the algebra, which means it commutes with everything else. So we have an extra element that we're adding to the algebra that commutes with everything else, but that appears when you do commutators of the other things. So now when we do the commutator of ln and lm, you're going to end up with this. Now, I'm not proving why this is the case, and it doesn't really matter. The point is, you can show that the only possible central extensions of the conformal algebra, or the Witt algebra that we considered before, are of this form. There are things that have some number here, and this is the expression. So for this, you're going to have to believe me, because we don't have way enough time to even attempt to do this. But this is the way you can do central extensions. So the fact that we're dealing with projective representations means that we, at the quantum level, can add these terms with a C that's non-zero, and we are still doing representations of the same thing, which was the Witt algebra. Okay, so the 12 here is just a choice. After all, C is an arbitrary constant. You can put any number you want here just for normalization purposes. And one thing that's important to notice is, well, first of all, this C is called the central charge. When you deal with central extensions, in our particular case, we're often going to call it the conformal anomaly. And why it's a conformal anomaly is going to be clear very soon. Now, something to note is that these commutation relations actually don't affect the ones with n and m, they are between minus 1 and 1. Because if you check them, this thing here, n times n squared minus 1, where you have n equal minus 1, 0, 1, it just goes to 0, regardless. This is really n times n minus 1 times n plus 1. So if you just look at the subalgebra, which is just the generators of, remember, it was rotations, dilations, translations, and special conformal transformations, everything stays exactly the same. It's only when you're dealing with the infinite dimensional algebra that this thing appears. And this is just something that happens in actual CFTs. We're not putting this for fun. It is actually there. Is this clear? What's happening? OK, so this is a very important thing. If you use this Virasoro algebra, which, by the way, I'm going to write down because we're going to need it later. So if you use that formula, and again use the trick of the integrals, and you do the integration by trying to match all the terms, you can find the OPE of T with itself. And again, we're doing the radial ordering, so the things make sense. And we're not doing all the steps, but I may just give them to you for the homework. They're not complicated. They're just using the same trick over and over again. And this happens. So this happens assuming that the Virasoro algebra has those commutation relations. So notice that this term appears here with a C over 2 in front of it, and there's a Z minus, there's a typo. This is supposed to be to the power 4. I knew there was going to be a typo somewhere. This is why I don't like slides, because you cannot fix the typos. Okay, so I'm going to write it here. This is going to be C over 2, and we have Z minus W to the power 4 plus other things. So the important thing is that this is to the power 4. So this you can just show using those relations. And there are two very important things about this expression. Anything you notice here? If you try to compare it to the one that we had for phi.
It's almost like if T was primary.
So yes, it's almost as if it was primary. If C is 0, then T is actually primary. So T can be primary, but in general, it's not going to be. And in fact, it's almost a primary field. And if you look at it, because this is 0, then you're just going to have H bar is 0. But then H is going to be this number that you can read off in front of the field, which is 2. So it looks like it's a primary field with this conformal dimension, but it's not because of this thing. So while classically we would expect it to be a primary field, we would expect it to transform the way a primary field does, at the quantum mechanical level, we have this here. So that's why we call it the conformal anomaly, because it's an anomaly that appears at the quantum level in this OPE. We don't expect it here. It breaks the fact that T should be primary, but that's what happens. Now, the important thing about this relation is that we derived it using the assumption of the Virasoro algebra, but you can just go and do this thing when I give you a theory. I give you a Lagrangian, you figure out what the energy momentum tensor is, you take the OPE of the energy momentum with itself, and you're going to find something. When it looks like this, and you have a number here, you figure out what the central charge is. We're actually going to do this afternoon. You're going to figure out what the central charge is for just a bosonic, just Klein-Gordon type equation. And you can find exactly what C is going to be in the case, and you're going to find out that C is not 0. So that's where C appears. So it's not just mathematical thing about putting an extra term here, it's actually appearing when you find out work with the real theory. So that's why we need to use it. Yes?
Yeah.
So the fact that if you have the central charge, so T is not a primary operator, primary field. So does it mean that energy is not creating time translation, for example? Is that something like this? Like that T is not the general, I mean, it's not associated to a conserved charge with the killing.
Okay, so you're asking, so what is the interpretation of this fact that it's an anomaly? Well,
of the fact that it's not a primary.
Yeah, so we're going to see something in a bit. So remember that T is of this form. Now the generators of things are the Ln and L bar n. So these things are going to be generating stuff. And we're going to see later that the ones that we hear about generating energy and so on, they are related to only some of these things, and those don't break because they are some of the ones that are not affected by the central charge. So remember, there are some of these Ln, Lm that they don't care about the central charge. The commutation ratios are just the same as the ones you would expect if C was zero. So for that part, nothing is going to break, which is what's going to happen later. So that's not going to affect the physics too much. But it's still important to have the central charge there. Yes?
Is there any relationship between this discussion, between the appearance of this central charge and the discussion that we've had previously when we look at quantum field theory in general, that we, instead of looking at the Poincaré group, we look at SL2C? Because it appears for the same reason, right? People say, like, we're interested in projective representations of the Poincaré group, and by some theorem, since the Poincaré group is not simply connected, the projective representation theory is going to be the same as the projective.
That's very much related to that, yes.
If it's double cup.
So we're not going to do all the things, but since I'm here, I'm just going to tell you. So the idea is this. Why do we need central extensions? In general, we want projective representations. So we have a group, say the Poincaré group, we want projective representations. And this is the same thing that happens with SO3. For example, this is why spin appears. We have SO3, we want representations of SO3 on our Hilbert space. Because it must be projective, we're going to have projective representations. Now, we don't like projective representations. They're not nice. We like representations because they have nicer features. And there are theorems that allow you to lift a projective representation to an actual representation of something else. Now, it turns out that if your group is simply connected, then you can take your projective representation and lift it to a representation of the same group. So no problem there. So if you start with SU2, the projective representations of SU2, you can just make them into representations of SU2. The projective representations of SO3, they lift to the what's called the universal cover. You have to take some cover of SO3, which is simply connected. And that's SU2. So that's how you start with something that's SO3, and then you end up with a representation of SU2 instead at the quantum level, and that gives you half integer spin. So that's where spin appears. It's the same thing. And now this works because there is no central extension that's non-trivial. In general, this trick that you do of taking a representation and lifting it to another representation is not just going to lift it to representation of another group, is going to lift it to a central extension of the representation. So lucky for us, for most things, central extensions are trivial, so you don't have to worry about it. So Poincaré group, you just had to find a simply connected cover, and that's it. For the Virasoro algebra, we have the problem that it has a central extension. Actually, problem is a bad word. It's not a problem, it's a feature. Because it gives you something at the quantum level that you wouldn't expect. And it's just something that happens because quantum. So this is how this stuff is appearing. So yes, it's very much related to all that. Any other questions? OK, so now we're almost done with this part, and we can go on and talk about the Hilbert space. Now that we have these generators, we want to know how they act on our fields, specifically our primaries. And the action, because they form a Lie algebra, the action that we're going to have on other states is going to be the adjoint action. So they act by taking the commutator. And you can check, again, this is not a complicated calculation. In fact, you can do it in a few different ways. You can either do the integrals and then match the terms, or other ways as well. So the action of ln on phi z z bar is going to be this. So you're going to get h, then you get an n plus 1 zn, which is essentially a derivative of zn plus 1. And remember, we are supposed to get, in fact, the derivative of psi. But psi is z to the n plus 1 in this case. And then we're going to have just z to the n plus 1, which is psi times the derivative of phi. And again, there's a typo. This is supposed to be ln bar. If you do the one with the ln bar, you're going to get the other two pieces, which have an h bar here, z bar, derivative with respect to z bar. So if you put these things together, you're going to get the general action of any conformal transformation that we've seen before. So this all makes sense. So this is not really important. What's important is, for future purposes, what happens when z is 0. So when z is 0, we're going to get, well, all the times that have z disappear unless whatever's on top is 0. So when you use L0, you're going to find here z to the 0, which just goes to 1. N plus 1 just becomes 1. This time disappears, and you're just going to have h times phi of 0, 0. So another way that you can find out what the conformal dimension is just check the eigenvalues of L0 at point z, z bar equals 0, 0. And similarly, L bar 0 commutated with f phi at 0, 0 is going to give you the h bar phi 0, 0. Now, something to notice, technically, whenever I put 0, 0 in, I should take limits. Because 0, 0 is not really a point in our space. Because our space, we're mapping the cylinder to a complex plane. That map doesn't actually map anything to 0, 0. We're saying that it maps the infinite past to 0, 0, in the sense that if you take the limit as the time goes to minus infinity, you get 0, 0. So we're always taking limits to 0, 0, but just writing limits all the time is just going to confuse us. So whenever you see phi of 0, 0, think of it as limit as z, z bar goes to 0, 0. Now, this one is very important for later. In fact, I'm going to write down these things. If n is greater or equal than 1, when you plug in 0, then this is going to be 0 to some positive power. It's going to disappear. And this is going to be 0 to some positive power. It disappears, and you get 0. This is both true for ln and L bar n. And what happens for n negative, that's a completely different question. But at this point, we don't care. So I'm just going to write the one for L without the bar, because the other ones are the same. You just get an extra bar on top of something. Do this make sense? Okay, so we're done with the first part. Now, before we start the second part, are there questions about what we're doing? Is it mostly clear? There's not that many calculations going around this time. So it's quite simpler, although I'm just adding some of them. Okay, so at this point, we get to asymptotic states. And now it gets a bit more fun, because there's actually going to be things we have to figure out, and I'm going to have you figure out things instead of just telling you stuff. Okay, so remember that, as we discussed, we're using radial quantization. So we have z is not x plus y, it's the exponential of x plus y. Y is going to be just the coordinate on the slice of a cylinder, so it just goes from 0 to 2 pi, minus pi to pi, or whatever you want to use. And when z is 0, we're describing the infinite past. Now, this means that we can introduce something like this. We can talk about asymptotic in states. So they are states at time equals minus infinity. And it makes sense, and we can do this in 2D CFTs, because we have a single point, that's z equals zero, that describes the infinite past of the whole cylinder. So even though we have a whole slice of a cylinder in the past, it's mapped to a single point. So it actually makes sense to talk about a single state that depends on the field, because it doesn't actually depend on position anymore. So this is just something that happens in this particular case, which is why we like it so much. So we're going to define our phi in associated to phi, so phi is a primary operator, in this way. We have some vacuum state. We're going to assume there's a vacuum state in our theory. And we prepare the state by applying phi of z z bar, which remember is an operator. And we're going to take the limit as time goes to minus infinity. So in this sense, it's an asymptotic state. Now, this thing here, I'm going to talk about it later too, but this is called the operator state correspondence. So it's something that we can do in 2D CFT, which is we have an operator, we associate a state to it. And as it turns out, you can also go back, you can take the state and recover the operator. Okay, so this is the asymptotic in state. Now, let's say we want an out state, something that's asymptotic in the future. How do we do that?
Why is that important about CFTs? That, I mean, I can always, like, take, if I choose a state, I can always multiply every operator by that state and define that to be the state corresponding to that operator A. And if the state is separating, then I obtain a correspondence between.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Why is this special? You can always do that, of course. So you fix some time, or you put time is minus infinity, you're going to have your operator, you act on the ground state. That's great, but your operator depends on position. In general, your operator depends on time and position. So you can take time to go to minus infinity, but you're going to have one operator at each position. Positions are going to be continuous. You're going to get a lot of operators. While in this case, z and z bar go to a single point as time goes to infinity. So we get, for each operator, we get exactly one state at minus infinity. That's what's special about it. We are not going to get a whole set of states that depends on x at minus infinity, when t is minus infinity. So that's what's special about this particular thing and why we can do this correspondence.
So it is not, so it is more than a state operator correspondence, it's a state field correspondence.
Yes. When I'm saying operator, I mean it's technically an operator field. Yes, so you're right. You can always correspond states to operators. Just talk to the operator on the state. What we're doing is we're taking the whole field and we're attaching to it a single state in a unique way. So the one-to-one correspondence is not between the field at one point and the state. It's the whole field at any point, and of course time is minus infinity, and the state. So that's what we're doing. So back to my question. If this is the asymptotic state at minus infinity, what do we do for plus infinity?
I mean, the point is, but at plus infinity, we have the circle.
Yeah, so at plus infinity, we're going to have the whole circle. Well, that's the point at infinity. But I don't mean technical. I just mean, suppose I just give you this thing. Are you able to figure out what the out state is if I just give you the in state? Any guesses of what we should do?
Try to get the Hamiltonian from T and evolve with that.
Okay, so you want to evolve with the Hamiltonian. That's, there, it's quite simpler. Yes?
Can you invert in some way to map the zero out to infinity?
Yes, so you want to invert in some way to map the zero to infinity. That's what we're going to do eventually. So we're going to see that later. I just mean, forget about this thing. Forget about how the asymptotic state is actually defined. Suppose I just told you that we have some state phi n. It describes the asymptotic state in the past. You just have this. You don't have any information about how it's created. So there's no z, no phi. You just have this state. How do you build from that or figure out from that what the state is at infinity? What are the possible things you can do to phi? We're in a Hilbert space. And the only ingredient is phi itself. We don't have any other operators. We cannot act on it with anything. What do we do?
Take inner product.
OK, we take an inner product with what?
Do we have phi for every, I mean, do we only have one vector?
Suppose that we only have one vector.
If we evolve with itself, right?
OK, so what do we get if we take the inner product of phi with itself?
Normalize,
but what quantity is it? Is it a state?
It's a number.
It's a number. We don't want a number, we want another state. So using the inner product, how do we get another state from our state?
We don't have zero, right?
We don't have zero. Not, well, this is the only thing you can use. This and the inner product. Okay, that's okay. I'm going to tell you, but it's actually very easy. The only thing you can do is take the emission conjugate.
But you don't get a state back.
You do get a state back. This is essentially using the inner product. We are defining a new state, if you want to be fancy about it. We are defining, we are using the inner product in this way. So if we use something like this, we leave this ambiguous and we put a vector here, this now becomes a map that acts on vectors, or maybe it's the other way around. But the point is that you get something in a dual space, which is still a state. So that's what we're doing. We are taking this to be the dual of our in state. So the idea is that something that is in the actual space becomes out in the dual state. I guess it was a bit of a tricky question, but it's OK. We just try to figure it out. It doesn't always work. OK, so this is the way we're going to define our asymptotic outstate. Because it's kind of the only thing we can do. Or, I mean, as you were trying to do, you can actually try to figure out, OK, so if this is the limit we're done, then if we take the inversion, we take 0 to infinity, it's actually what you do later on. It turns out that these two things are exactly the same. Okay, so this is a definition, but we have a problem. What's our inner product? What does it mean to take the adjoint? We didn't actually specify any inner product on our space. We don't have any idea what the adjoint of things are, because we didn't specify the inner product. So that's what we have to do now.
Did we specify what zero was?
We just assumed there's a ground state. So no, we didn't really specify it. It's a quantum field theory. If we don't have a ground state, we have a big problem. So just assume there's a ground state.
But we do have a notion of what is the expectation value of the product of two operators. That's what we've been working with all the time, right?
Yes. So you're saying, what's the expectation value of the product of operators? Yes, we've been working with it. Just assume there's an inner product.
So
it just, we didn't specify what it is. Yes.
Is phi 1 inner product phi 2 is the expectation value in that ground state of the field corresponding to phi out and the field corresponding to phi in?
Not completely sure. The maximum is something that breaks, because otherwise people will not be worrying about this. So we do need a notion of what's happening. So let's see what happens. It's entirely possible that you need to require that your ground state, when you define your correlators, you're kind of assuming that you really only care about phi, about zero. So we just need the dual for zero. So suppose that we figured out the dual for zero. Now what we're trying to do is figuring out the dual for everything else. So the idea here is matching the notion of a joint in such a way that you get the dual of zero the same way you had defined it before. So this may be what's happening. Okay, so now this is a bit weird, but then it relates to the idea of switching zero with infinity. Now, if you were working in Minkowski space, we would expect that when you take emission conjugates of fields, this doesn't affect the coordinates x and time and x or whatever coordinates are using. But we're not in Minkowski space. We are using Euclidean coordinates. We're using with the weak rotated coordinate x equals it. So this means that when we take complex conjugates, we expect x to go to minus x. The time is going to actually change, at least the Euclidean time. Now, because of this, z, which is e to the x plus iy, when we do emission conjugation of the operator, we expect it to go to e to the minus x plus iy. But this is 1 over z bar. And this is the inversion. It's just not an holomorphic inversion, so this is not actually connected to the identity. But it's an inversion. So we're going to define our adjoint of this operator at point z, z bar. You're going to define it like this. We're going to put some function here that we have to figure out what it is. We're going to do that in a moment. And then we're going to take phi at 1 over z bar, 1 over z. So we're changing point. And that's why when we're doing this dual state, it's actually an out state. Because now as you take the limit for z that goes to 0, this goes to infinity and this goes to infinity. So you do get something at time infinity. That's why it is actually an out state. So this is just the way we're going to define it. Usually you're just told what f is and then later you show that it makes sense. I don't like that. So I'm just going to leave f arbitrary and we're going to figure out why it makes sense. Okay, so this is the general definition of what the adjoint of a primary operator is. Now let's figure out what f is. Any ideas how we figure out what f is? It's not a particularly easy question. Who knows? Maybe you know. Yes?
I know we could look on the maybe on the unit circle first. I don't know. Because phi of z will go to 1 over z is still...
Okay, so you're thinking to do the unit circle first? Well, the problem is the states we defined only have z equals to 0. So we're essentially to work with z equals 0. Okay, this is not exactly an easy question. I'm just going to tell you, otherwise you're going to just spend 10 minutes thinking about this. What we're going to do is make sure that the norm of the instate actually makes sense. The norm of the instate is the inner product of phi out and phi in. We want to make sure this is actually a well-defined thing. We don't want this to go to zero, otherwise we're going to get the zero state. So if we do this, we're going to get the limit of z, z bar goes to 0. We're going to get f, z, z bar, and we get this thing. Now, I cheated a bit here. It should be the limit of something else goes to 0, 0, but just drop the thing. Otherwise, we get too many limits. This expression becomes horrible. So just in the background, there's an extra limit here for the w that goes to 0. And if we just change our limits, we introduce a new variable, w is 1 over z. This is the same as the limit of f of 1 over w, 1 over w bar, and then we have this expression. And now this expression, we know something about. What's this? That's the correlation of phi with itself at two different points. And because we are doing a CFT, and we know our primary is transformed, we actually know what this is. We have done this at one of the tutorials, and Jaume has told you many times. So do you remember what happens for something like this? What do we expect?
So it's fully determined.
Can you repeat that?
It's a two-point function, so
yes. So it's a two-point function.
It's fully fixed by the.
Yeah, so it's going to be fully fixed. So we already know what this looks like, and what does it look like? I mean, ideally, we're not seeing this in complex coordinates, so it's a bit different. But just to get an idea, what's the shape of this thing? Does anyone remember?
W to the power.
Okay, so you expect 1 over W to some power, right? Now, even if you don't remember the power exactly, what is it related to? The scalar dimension. So in this case, we have two dimensions, NH and H bar. So it's going to be slightly different, and you get this. It's going to be 1 over W to the 2H bar and W bar to the 2H. Now, the reason why we're switching the W bar and the W is because I switched them here. And because we had 1 over Z bar and so on. The fact that we switched Z with 1 over Z bar makes the things mix. So now we get this thing, and notice that assuming that H is positive, which as we're going to see in a bit must actually be true, then this thing is going to go to 0 as W goes to infinity. We don't want that to happen. We want our state to actually be a well-defined state. If the inner product goes to 0, then the state is 0. We don't want the state to be 0, which means this f must match this thing. So it must be such that that gives you a number. So we're just going to choose f of z, z bar is z to the minus 2 h bar, z bar to the minus 2 h. So this is your definition for the adjoint of an operator. So part of it is because we are switching 0 with infinity, we want to do an inversion. But we also need some coefficient in front of it that depends on the point that just makes normalization work nicely. Otherwise, everything breaks. So this is just something we require. And it's not very important to actually remember this. It's just we had to do this. What's important to remember is what the consequences of this are. Can I switch to the next slide? Okay, so one can prove, and when I say one can prove, I mean you can prove on the homework, that this choice of Hermitian conjugation implies this for the Virasoro algebra. So Ln dagger is going to be L minus N, same thing for the bar. And this assuming that we require Tz and T bar Z to be self-adjoint, which makes sense. It's the energy momentum tensor, we want it to be self-adjoint.
Now, this is important. Notice that L naught and L bar naught are self-adjoint. Because 0 just going to be minus 0, which is still 0. And we're going to interpret L naught plus L bar naught as a Hamiltonian. So this goes back to something that you asked me before about what are we using for generating things and does the conformal charge affect things. Our Hamiltonian is L naught plus L bar naught is not affected by 0. Doesn't matter what the conformal charge is, the Hamiltonian is going to be fine. Now, why is this Hamiltonian? Remember, this is the generator of dilations in the complex plane. We've seen that a couple of lectures ago about conformal algebra of the complex plane. So if they generate dilations in the complex plane, what do they generate on the cylinder? So they go up and down. And what's up and down on our axis? Time. So they are time translations on the cylinder. That's why we take it to be the Hamiltonian, because the Hamiltonian is the generator of time transitions. So that's why we interpret this to be the Hamiltonian operator. What does I to the L naught minus L naught bar generate? In the complex plane, this generates rotations. So what does it generate in the cylinder?
I'm sorry, what do those generate, sorry?
This, on the complex plane, this is rotations.
So they generate translations.
Yeah, so it's going to be translations on the cylinder. It just moves around. At a fixed time, it moves around y. Okay, so now we can finally talk about the Hilbert space of CFD. We don't have a lot of time, but we don't have too many things to say, so we should be fine. Okay, so we've seen that we can associate to each primary operator an asymptotic instate. And this thing is known as the operator state correspondence. Sometimes field state correspondence, so that you don't get confused and you do get what you were asking me before, why is this different than usual QFD? Now we're going to figure out what the structure of these Hilbert spaces. And we see it as a representation of the Virasoro algebra. So we know what the inner product is. We defined it by choosing the notion of adjoint. There's a problem, but we're going to get to that later. The vacuum state. We want the vacuum state in such a way that this thing is well defined. The limit as z goes to 0 of t of z acting on 0, we want it to be well defined. It doesn't have to blow up or do weird things. Now, remember that t of z is written as a Lorentz series in terms of DLn. And there's a z to the minus n minus 2. That z to the minus n minus 2, when z goes to 0, is going to do weird things depending on the value of n. So specifically, this means that we must have ln acting on 0. It must be 0 when n is greater or equal to minus 1. Otherwise, this limit is not well defined. This thing is going to blow up as we go to 0. And we don't like that. So we're going to have to choose these things for physical reasons, because we want the energy momentum tensor to be well defined at 0. Now, similarly, L bar n at 0 is going to be 0. Yes?
And smaller than minus 1?
Greater or equal to minus 1.
Isn't that going to keep us?
Because we're going to have.
Oh, because it's z to the power.
Yes,
minus.
We have z to the minus n minus 2.
Four.
We want this not to go to infinity. So this means that minus n minus 2 must be greater or equal to 0. So n must be less or equal than something went wrong. So we want this to be so we have these times and that. So now we take the limit as n goes to 0. So this thing needs to be well defined. So we don't want to divide by things, but this is 1 over. To the n minus 2, n plus 2. So we want n plus 2 to actually be negative. So it must be less or equal to 0. Okay, so that fixes. That's it.
Yeah, we want to keep n smaller than minus 2, so we want to get rid of n bigger than.
Yes, exactly. So it's the opposite that we don't like. Yes. So this must be 0 when the opposite happens. It is confusing. I got confused too. I got even more confused because I know that this is supposed to be true. You don't know it yet. Okay, so this is something that must happen. So notice that the ground state must satisfy ln acting on 0, 0 when n is greater than or equal to minus 1. Now, we're going to use this definition in the following, just so we don't have to rewrite this thing all over again. I'm going to use h bar in a ket to describe this thing. It's the instate of some primary operator phi that has dimension h bar. And now we're going to notice that ln acting on h bar is the same as the commutator of ln with phi at 0, 0 acting on 0 plus phi 0, 0 ln acting on 0. This is ln acting on phi, but if you want to switch them, you have to include also the commutator part. But remember that we've calculated all these things. I have them right here. So what is L naught acting on HH1? Keeping in mind that those are the commutation relations of L and phi. It's very easy, just reading off the board. What is L0 commutated with phi at 0, 0? Yeah, so it's H. So we're going to get an H times. So we're going to get H times phi, yes, times H phi, because it's phi 0, 0 times 0. What about this thing? What happens to this term? What's L0 of 0?
0.
It's 0 because of what we saw just before. And similarly for L bar, we're going to get this. So these states, H, H bar, are actually eigenstates of both L0 and L bar 0. And H and H bar are the eigenvalues. What happens with when you have with the land and N is greater or equal than 1? What do you see from this and this? It's going to be 0. So, and same thing happens for L bar. So when N is greater or equal than 1, you act with the land on the states, you're going to get 0. And this is very helpful in moving to the next. We're almost done, by the way. Okay, so now note that when you look at the commutation relations of the Virasoro algebra, L naught commutated with the land gives you minus N and land. Same thing for this. So these are actually ladder operators, in the sense that L naught acting on Ln H, H bar gives you, again, Ln of H, H bar. So it's an eigenvector. And what it does is take H and subtract N. So depending on whether you're using the N positive or N negative, you're either going to increase the dimension or decrease the dimension. So that's what these things do. So now this state is an eigenvector of both L naught and L bar naught, and it's annihilated by all the lower operators. Now we call this kind of state a highest weight state. And if you're wondering why it's not the lowest weight state, that's because people call them highest states regardless. It doesn't matter if it's lowering or raising operators, you just call it highest states. It doesn't make any sense, I didn't make the rules. Now, is there a physical interpretation or motivation for why we require the in states to be highest weight states? Why do we require that when you use the lowering operators, you get zero acting on them? So remember that we have L naught plus L plus L naught is the Hamiltonian. So H plus H bar is going to be our energy. What happens to the energy if you don't require that our states satisfy the property that Ln, when n is greater than 1, annihilates them? Those are the lower operators.
You can break down the state, the energy, indefinitely.
So what happens to the energy?
It can be break down and down and down. And
yeah, so you can bring down the energy as much as you want. We don't want that. We want the energy to be bounded below. And the only way you can do that is by requiring this thing. So physically, what we're doing by asking that the state is annihilated by the lowering operators is that we have bound from below for the energy. But we can raise the energy to whatever we want. Now, the states that we built, they are essentially the start of our representation. This is analogous to representations of, say, SU2 or just harmonic oscillator. You find the ground state, then from that you start building everything else using the raising operators. Same idea here. We have our highest weight states. We build all the others by applying all the other lowering raising operators. So actually, this should be raising, not lowering operators. The only problem is that, unlike the harmonic oscillator, we have infinitely many raising operators, not just one of them. So we're going to have a lot of different kind of vectors. So examples are going to be this state, which is going to have eigenvalues h plus 2 h bar, because we are adding 2 with l minus 2. then L bar minus 1 is going to add 1 to the H bar component. This one is going to add to both of them. So there's a lot of possible states that you can build out of this. Okay, so this is the last thing we have to talk about. We're already a bit over time, so I'm not even going to attempt talking about null states, but this is important. As it turns out, we have an inner product and everything is nice, but the way we define things, there are vectors that may have negative norm. We don't like that. So we're going to say the CFT is unitary if all the states have non-negative norm. So in the terms of 2D CFTs, unitarity means that the states have non-negative norm. And I'll show you how things can go wrong. If you start with this vector, L minus 1 of each H bar, starting with one of the highest weight states, you act with L minus 1, then you take the norm. Then I'm going to have H bar L1, which is the adjoint of L minus 1, acting on H bar. And we don't know how to do this, but we can always use the commutation relations, and we can make this into this one. The other terms drops because L1 acting on H bar is just 0. And the commutator of L1 with L minus 1 is 2 L0. But L0, we know how it acts on these things, it gives you 2H. So as it turns out, this thing, which is supposed to be positive, is proportional to H. So this means that unless H is greater or equal than 0, we have a non-unitary CFT. So we must have dimensions always positive if we want unitarity in our theorem. And the same thing happens about H bar, by the way. Just replace bars everywhere, and this tells you that H bar must be greater or equal than 0. So this is one of the requirements that we need. It's not the only way of doing this, and it's just a necessary condition. Just because H is positive does not mean we're safe. Just we need this, otherwise we're not safe. And you can actually constrain also the central charge with this requirement. So for example, you have L minus 2 acting on the ground state. Now this is going to be essentially the correlator of L2 and L minus 2. Because of the fact that L minus 2 dagger is L2. Same trick as before, you just commutate them, the other terms drops, and this time the commutator is L0 plus 3C. So this time we have the central charge appearing, because the commutator of L2 and minus 2 is going to have a central charge. But L0 acting on 0 is just 0, so we get this. And we should assume that the ground state is not a zero vector, otherwise we have a very trivial theory. So this means that C must be greater or equal than zero, otherwise unitarity breaks. So both H and C must be greater or equal than zero. Now you can keep playing this game over and over again. And you're going to find more and more requirements for C and H. We're not going to play this game because we're way over time. But if you do this, eventually you get this theorem. That tells you that the CFT is unitary if and only if one of the following happens. Either you have both C greater or equal than 1 and H greater or equal than 0, or you are in this situation. I'm not going to read over these things, and I want to spend much time over it, just a result, and I'm going to post the slides anyway. But the point is, there are only some ways of making the CFT unitary. You cannot just choose any C and H and be happy about it. And by the way, when I talk about H, I mean individually for each one of the primaries. So this limits the kind of primaries you can have in your theory. That's what people mean when they say that your theory in 2D CFT is a lot simpler, you can impose lots of constraints, and then in some cases it's solvable, because you have a lot of constraints on what your theory can actually be. You cannot have any possible collection of operators. You are constrained by these things. So for example, if you're in this case, there's finitely many weights that you can have. H cannot be anything you want because you have just some integers. Once you fix C, you're fixing M, and then you just have some ways of fixing the possible conformal dimension. Okay, so that was essentially it. Now, if you want to go, you can go. If you want to stay for the last slide, you can stay for the last slide. What do you want to do? There's no formulas. You're just writing. I'm just going to tell you what null states are, but if you don't care, I'm happy to stop here.